1975, the city of Boston was in the midst of violent protests over court-ordered busing to desegregate its public schools. The city itself remained racially segregated, and both the black and white communities were on edge. This was the atmosphere in which James Bowden Jr., an unarmed black man, a husband and father, was gunned down by police officers as he left his mother's house. The killing and subsequent trial of two Boston police officers is the subject of Deadly Force, a police shooting, and My Family's Search for the Truth, written by Lawrence O'Donnell, the host of The Last Word on MSNBC. First published in 1983, this timely paperback edition, reissued by William Morrow, features a new preface and afterword. And I'm very pleased it has brought Lawrence O'Donnell here to discuss the issue. Welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So before we get into the book, I'd like to talk first about your recent reporting of the immigration crisis from the Texas-Mexico border. Where were you for your reporting and how long have you been there?
I was in Brownsville, which is the southernmost point of Texas, and it is the easternmost point of the border. The Rio Grande River empties into the Gulf of Mexico at Brownsville, and it is one of the really big border crossing areas legally, and that region, of course, is one of the big border crossing regions that are used illegally. And so it's right in the center of the storm. It's where the these jails are. You know, we've been struggling for a word for these places. I've been to jails, I've been to prisons, and I've been to detention. I used to get detention in high school. That's what they called it if you had to stay after school because you were a bad boy. They called it detention. So I just can't use this word detention for these things, detention centers. There's some kind of politeness in that that people are trying to achieve by using that language.
Right.
I mean the people who originated the language, the government. You know, I was able to find on my first day there where the girls are and where some of the babies are because one of the people in the area saw diapers outside this jail. And by the way, one of the things that's challenging about the semantics is these places used to be Walmarts. They used to be, you know, stores in malls. And so you're standing outside of it, and you're seeing this big parking lot. And by the way, everybody knows a Walmart parking lot's pretty big, right? Parking lot's just about full. That's how many people have jobs that are dependent on this.
Tremendous.
This is a giant business at the border. And so, you know, I was able to stand there and say to our audience, you know, this is where the girls are. This is where infant babies are. But all I can do is point to the building. That's the closest we can get.
So I feel like the prevailing word in the headlines, particularly since the quote unquote executive order, is confusion, right, in terms of how to get children back to their families if those efforts are happening. How would you characterize the confusion that you've seen in your reporting and in the lay of the land in terms of path forward for even reunification for these children that have already been separated?
Well, they don't know how to do it. You know the government doesn't know how to do something when the government says we're going to create a task force to do it. The reason you're creating the task force is you don't know how to do it.
Right.
They don't, when they say, you know, we're going to invade Afghanistan, which they'd never done before, when they say we're going to invade Iraq the first time and the second time, they don't say we're going to create a task force. They know how to do it. The Defense Department has done it before. Our military knows how to execute military missions. So what they've done in the haste with which they've done it is they have separated parents and children and babies and infant babies and nursing babies. And the truth of it is they don't know how to put them back together. They didn't have a system for it. This wasn't you checking your luggage at the airport. That's a system that's been around for a very long time. And it fails a fair amount, but it usually, after an initial failure, will end up finding your suitcase. Because of that thing you're holding, that ticket. So these parents aren't being given any ticket. They're given no receipt for their child. The child is given no method of ever finding their parents again when they're separated from them. There's 3,000 kids. The media constantly understates the number dramatically. There's this number 2300 that you'll see graphically on the screen of every cable news channel. It's completely wrong.
Right.
And it is the laziness of the news media that does this. That number, which was over 2300, is a June 9th number. The government continued to do this for another 2 weeks at a rate of between 70 and 100 a day. So the real number is somewhere above 3,000, and we don't know the real number. And to state it at 2,300 is to begin the size of the problem with a falsehood.
Right, and just try to cap the crisis at that. You know, I can't help but worry that the government, in fact, is never going to be capable of reuniting these kids, and it's going to be a patchwork of community organizations.
The people who are going to reunite them, and I think the only people who are going to reunite them, are private attorneys who get engaged as immigration attorneys, who are good at investigative work, who, especially the ones, if bigger, richer law firms get involved on a pro bono basis, they can afford to send someone down to Honduras or down to El Salvador, where the parent now is, and work it from both ends, trying to find the baby in the United States and the parent in Central America. But the government's not going to do that.
Do you have faith that they will be reunited?
No. No one should have any faith that they're going to be reunited. Mm-hmm. And just ask yourself what faith you would have if this had happened to you in a foreign country and that you'd never dealt with and whose language you don't speak, whose customs and legal processes you don't understand. And no one in that country could tell you where your child was.
Imagine the press-stopping horror of an American experienced a similar thing in another country. It just would be unspeakable from our point of view, right?
It would be, and there would be all sorts of objection at the United Nations over it.
All right, so I want to move on to the book because it's equally important to discuss at this point. Deadly Force, A Police Shooting and My Family's Search for the Truth. What made you want to revisit this story 35 years after it was originally published?
Michael Brown made me want to revisit it because when I was covering the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, we saw the first cable news reaction to a police shooting like this. We had seen events like this occur in the past, but they all actually predated cable news. And by events like this, I don't mean just the police shooting, but I mean the community reaction after the fact, including repeated nights of rioting. We had seen that in Miami in the 1980s over Arthur McDuffie, a name that has been forgotten. We had seen that in a variety of places, but not since the invention of cable news. And so this was the very first time where we saw something like this happen, and we had cameras on the street corners of Ferguson 24 hours a day. And we had the internet, and we had, therefore, much, much better information about what was going on and what was happening. The Michael Brown coverage created what has become kind of a beat in news now. It never was before
That's
Michael Brown.
It
never was. If I said to you, who on your local newspaper is the one who's been doing the best work on police use of deadly force, the answer throughout the country would be no one. And so, and if I said in any news organization, who's your person who knows the most about police use of deadly force? It'd be zero, nobody, anywhere. And so it became a specialty, in fact, for some reporters after that who've done fantastic work since then. The Washington Post has done phenomenal work in trying to track exactly how many people are killed by police in a year, which is a number we do not know.
Do not know, yeah.
And we deliberately don't know it because the FBI, in their crime statistics, has been prevented from collecting it. The Congress has said you are not allowed to collect that number. And so we've never known it. We've always been doing estimates. In the age of the internet and cable news, we're doing much better estimates than we were 35 years ago when I was trying to do my own social science. There really was no social science on this subject at the time. And so I was literally, when I was writing this book, clipping with a scissors articles out of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and these different newspapers that I would find around the country that would have an incident in it. And we were able to put together very, very rough estimates about what was happening out there. What we knew to the absolute certainty were how many police officers were being killed. And that is a dramatically lower number than the number of people right. they kill. And that number has been going down dramatically over time. And so the job of police work has actually become statistically and provably statistically much less dangerous over the last 35 years, much less dangerous. And so the justification for shooting has diminished to a certain extent if you're looking just at the statistics,
right.
the statistical picture of it, which is not an adequate picture for human engagements like this. And so I wanted people to realize this is the way these cases have always been handled. The frustration that you have that nothing has happened with the police officer in the Eric Garner case, who was shown on video suffocating a man. We see it happen. We see him say, "I can't breathe." We basically watch him on his way to death on that video, and nothing. New York City Police Department's done nothing with the officer who did that. They haven't even completed their so-called disciplinary action. That's the kind of thing that has not only been going on forever, but that was the norm. That was the norm prior to the cable news era, prior to the internet era, and prior to what is the most important development in the history of American police work, and that is private video.
Mm-hmm.
Private video, the very first video.
Rodney King.
Yeah, Rodney King was one of those big, bulky home video cameras. They now seem big and bulky compared to what we all have in our pockets. But the Rodney King video changed the world for white people only, because black America knew that things like what we saw happen to Rodney King on that video, black America knew that was happening every day in America to black men in America generally. And people in and around police work knew that it was happening every day. White America had never seen it, and it shocked white America. And it stopped white America in a way that nothing else in the history of police work ever had. Bill Bradley went out, a New Jersey senator, went out on the Senate floor, the floor of the United States Senate, and talked about police use of deadly force for the first time in the history of the United States Senate because of what he saw on the Rodney King video. And he took a pencil, as I recall. I was working in the Senate. I was on the Senate floor at the time. And he tapped his podium the number of times that Rodney King was hit with a club, and it was 40-something. It was a ridiculously high number. And it was probably, it was without question, the most dramatic and compelling moment I'd ever seen on the floor of the United States Senate. That wouldn't have happened without the video. We have, you know, this most recent case in Pittsburgh where we have video of the victim of the police bullets being shot in the back. We know it. We don't need the autopsy report. The autopsy report will confirm this. But we see on the video that he's running away from the police officer. He is shot in the back.
And the book, and the year after your book was published originally, that became illegal.
Yes. So, yeah. My book was really the very first public treatment of police use of deadly force. The Supreme Court had never really thought about it. I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times a couple of years before the book came out, which was about police use of deadly force. That was the first time the New York Times had ever mentioned the subject. And so a year after my book comes out, the United States Supreme Court makes the most important change they could have made at the time. They struck down laws that said, in some states, that it was legal to shoot and kill a fleeing felony suspect. So you could be running away completely unarmed, and it was legal in that state for the police officer to shoot and kill that person. Supreme Court said that law is unconstitutional. It did not say, and there's a certain misinterpretation at that point. People started to believe, oh, it says you cannot shoot and kill a fleeing suspect, period, no complications. It's slightly more complicated than that. What it meant when it said you cannot write a law in your state that makes that legal, it left open then what happens when someone does shoot someone who's fleeing. And so the story that police always adopted, and this language appeared in police reports I read all over the country. When they shot someone in the back and they knew the autopsy was going to show they shot someone in the back running away from them, their reports always said he turned in a threatening manner as if to shoot. And I can recite that from memory from 40 years ago and from every year since, because that phrase appears every time. Without the video, you don't know whether that is true. And it's the video that has made that defense impossible in the instances where we have seen the video where, no, he did not turn in any manner whatsoever, threatening or otherwise. He did not turn. So video has become the modern defense or the modern truth teller in these cases. And so the story I'm telling in the book is a very personal story. It's the story of the way things were before the age of video. And it's the story of the way things still are for every case that does not include personal video made by a private citizen. Because we've discovered, even with the police cams, that they're willing to tamper with those. The body cams, the police are willing to tamper with those, shut them off, erase them, do whatever they have to do to make them irrelevant to the fact-finding process. And so the story that's told in this book is still happening in this country constantly. We will, in most of these instances, never know the truth of what happened. We got to the truth in this story really exclusively because of my father. And it's a very personal story. He was a Boston cop who ended up, he was actually a pretty bad high school student, and he was a Boston cop, and he ended up going to college and law school nights while he was a Boston cop. And he had become a very successful criminal defense lawyer in Boston. And James Bowden's widow came to him to tell her story about how her husband was killed in the hope that he might be able to do something for her, because a friend of hers in her neighborhood, her black neighborhood in Boston, had a cousin who my father had once represented and took his case all the way to the Supreme Court and was successful with it. And so she came in and told my father her story, and he immediately took the case. And I don't think we ever would have found out the truth any other way, because it needed all the skills he had as a former cop. He was taking on his own police department, and it was a very dramatic, very personal war that went on for years in him using everything he knew about the way police cover up these things and everything he knew as a trial lawyer in order to make it all fit in an admissible evidentiary way in a courtroom and finally win.
I'm speaking with Lawrence O'Donnell about his new edition of his 1983 book, Deadly Force, A Police Shooting and My Family's Search for the Truth. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. I'm D.W. Gibson, speaking with Lawrence O'Donnell about his book, Deadly Force, A Police Shooting and My Family's Search for the Truth. So, how long had your father been out of the police force when he took on the case?
He'd been out of the, probably 25 years or so.
So what was it for him in terms of friendships? I mean, were there those you talk about? This is a very personal story, an intricate story. Talk about how he managed those relationships.
Well, you know, a police force is a big collection of people, and they don't all think the same way. And so in this story, it's the younger cops, the younger, more aggressive cops who shot this James Bowden when he was just had just gotten into his car, because his car in their minds fit the description of a car used in a robbery earlier in the day. It was proven that it was not that car. And they basically ran up to the car and shot him in the back and the back of the head, and without any kind of warnings at all. And we had witnesses who testified to that. And the older police officers who were in my father's class, they were all at that point sergeants. They tended to be at that point sergeants and above, including the command staff. And they knew what this was, and they understood my father's position, as I would put it. And they had no problem with him going after this the way he was going after it, except the police commissioner himself, Joe Jordan, who was also of my father's era. He was really upset about what my father was doing. And the reason for that is that we discovered in all of the reports that Joe Jordan was very much complicit in the cover-up. And indeed, when the book first came out in Boston in the 1980s, it drove Joe Jordan out of his job. He lost his job over this. And so, there was a large number of cops in that department who would never have said anything about this publicly. They were never going to turn anybody in. They were never going to say that was a planted gun that they put on the scene near the car. They were never going to do any of that. But they were also perfectly okay with my father doing what he was doing. The younger ones, it was very much a war for them because they didn't know my father. And so they didn't know him at all. And they misjudged him and they tried different threats against him, which made it only worse.
How did he respond to those threats?
This is wicked hard for me to discuss because it's very much a Boston story, and it's a Boston Irish wise guy story on both sides. Okay, we're all from the same neighborhood. One of these cops involved in the case was a little league coach of mine. We're all very much cut from the same stock, which is very profane, and very wise guy. And so when you ask me how people reacted, what I hear in my head are words that I can't say on the radio,
right?
Okay? Because I know what they said, and I know how they react to these kinds of things. And by the way, which made, just parenthetically, doing the audiobook an incredible challenge because it's just filled with Boston accents, and each one of them is slightly different. You know, like my father's Boston accent is one thing, and you know, Sergeant Gagin's Boston accent is different, they really thought that they could intimidate him, you know, out of handling this case. And it just got him angrier, is my most polite way of saying that on the radio.
So your experience...
And all of these personal dynamics are very much a part of the book. And it made it an incredible challenge to write because I had to tell stories in there, including family stories, that I didn't know I was going to tell when I began the book, including some, you know, family secrets, things that formed my father as a kid, the way his father died, which was a tragic story in itself. I didn't know that I was going to have to tell those stories in this book. And I read something around that time, the time I was working on this book, where I read about Norman Mailer, who had been doing a fair amount of nonfiction at that point in time, talking about what he called the sanction to write. That if you take on the job of writing and writing about real people, you have to sanction yourself to say what has to be said about them. And he made a reference as an example, like if he was ever really going to write about his mother, he would be saying things he knows that would deeply offend and hurt his mother,
right,
as well as things that his mother would like. But if he's doing the whole picture, he's going to have to sanction himself, you know, to write about his mother. And, you know, and I had to do that with my father and my brother Michael, my brother Kevin, my brother Bill, all of whom were heroic soldiers in this war. And there were times when, you know, my brothers would come to me and say, you know, you can't say that about the old man, mm-hmm. meaning my father.
Yeah.
That's the way we talked to him. We always called him the old man. I go, you can't say that about the old man. What if the people know? And I go, I have to, you know, and they didn't understand it. And so there was this very dramatic night in the summer of 1983 when I got my first publisher's copies of the book. And I gave the first one to my father that night, and he stayed up all night and read it. And he came in to talk to me first thing the next morning, and all he said was, I loved it. And it's filled with, you know, negative information about his tempers and about his, you know, different things about him as a character. He's by far the most complex character in the story. And he understood every bit of that. He completely understood that sanction to write.
It has to have those complications, right? Otherwise, the story doesn't come alive.
Yeah, it does. It really, really does. You know, and one of the women in this story who I truly love was really, really very, very, very much overweight. And I remember staring at that and thinking, how do I describe her without using the word fat? How do I do that? And so I found myself saying, you know, she had gained a lot of weight in her first pregnancy and never lost it. And I left it at that. You know, she wasn't that important a character that where you had to get everything, you know, cruelly correct, I guess is the way I would put it. But in a personal story like this, and this book is as I say, deeply personal with my mother and my brothers and my father and these cops that I know and I knew personally, you know, a former, you know, baseball coach of mine who was on the bad side of this story,
right,
that I had to be fair to all of them. I had to tell you the good things about Billy Dwyer as a baseball coach of mine, and that Billy Dwyer was lying about a murder, and that Billy Dwyer didn't care about that. I had to get all of Billy Dwyer in this story.
See, and that's what's so very important for white Americans, because we can so easily brush aside the complications of our mothers and fathers and little league coaches, sort of airbrush out the stuff that we don't want and accept the goodness in them. But I think this is the linchpin for white America getting to the heart of this issue, right?
Yeah, and you know, this is legally, you know, when it happens, when the story unfolds after the shooting, this is kind of a white on white war, legal war over years. And it's a really, you know, tight cultural war of Boston Irish versus Boston Irish, Boston Irish former cop versus Boston Irish cops. And it is very intense. And you see the connective tissues that all these people share. I mean, you could spend a certain amount of time, you know, talking about how similar, you know, my father is and certainly his upbringing was to the cops who did this killing. But you at a certain point have to concentrate on, okay, what changed them? Why did this one change? Why did this patrolman, Lawrence O'Donnell, change? And when did he change? And over what period of time did he change? And that actually relates to my previous book, Playing with Fire, about the 1968 presidential election, because, you know, Bobby Kennedy's obviously a character in that. And one of the things that comes up about Bobby Kennedy all the time in that story and others is, what happened to this, you know, kind of moderate Democrat, some would say at certain points conservative Democrat in the 1950s, Bobby Kennedy, to becoming close to or the most liberal Democrat by 1968? And the answer to that is everyone changed. There wasn't one adult in America who thought the same thing about everything in 1960 as that person thought in 1968. Well, my father's one of those people. My father's growing up in an intensely racist, anti-Semitic place called Irish Boston. And it's way more anti-Semitic and racist when he's growing up than it is when I'm growing up. And when I was growing up, it was still very, very, very racist and anti-Semitic. And he's growing up in that with all of those prejudices. And he somehow transcends those prejudices. He, you know, you could go into my friends' houses when I was a kid. This was rare. It was rare, but I did hear it. And you would hear parents using the N-word. And as it happens, the only ones that I did, it so happens, were Boston cops, fathers of friends of mine. And I'm sure others did, but they didn't. They tended not to do it in front of their kids. It was even in the 1960s, it was like a word you stopped. If you had used it, you didn't use it in front of your kids. It was almost considered profanity. You know, and in our house, it was like, it was impossible. You couldn't possibly, you know, hear that word ever, you know, from my father or my mother or anybody who they knew. And so we were all living through an increasing period of enlightenment about this. You know, Martin Luther King came into our consciousness in the 1960s. He taught us all a lot, and he deserves credit for changing a lot of minds. I mean, I saw Martin Luther King Jr. at least change racist vocabularies in Boston in the 1960s, to the point where, you know, the language actually did have to publicly change. And so, you know, this is a look at a bunch of characters at a point in American history, in American police history, where the definition of right and wrong has not been publicly declared. There had been no public declaration that police should not kill people for no reason. There had been no, you know, active outward protest about it at that point in time. And these people are working their way through their own attitudes about it. I mean, Billy Dwyer, literally my baseball coach, gets the last word in the book, really in the story of it, where, you know, he, at the end of the whole battle, we end up being chummy again, which is a thing that's, I can't explain it to people outside of the Boston Irish culture. I just can't, because we were ready to kill each other at many points during this story. And at the end of it all, we're standing there in a courthouse, and Billy Dwyer makes a very casual reference to the killing of James Bowdoin. And he says, you know, he and his partner, Mark Malloy, he says that they knew right away that it was a bad shooting.
Mm-hmm.
But then he said, you know, basically, you know, it wasn't our problem. We didn't give a, you know.
Yeah.
He said it in a profane way. And that is the real character study difference. And I wish I could tell you why Billy Dwyer, who grew up in the same neighborhood I did, could stand there and say, you know, we don't care. And these O'Donnell brothers are standing there in the same courthouse, in the same hallway, grown up in the same neighborhood, and we do care. And if we can figure out what the difference is between those two views from those people growing up the same way in the same place, then we're going to, at some point, be able to move this culture forward in a way that it still hasn't. But I'm telling you, I have not figured out what the difference is between me and those guys, those Boston cops who killed James Bowdoin.
Well, and in the quick minute we have left, the thing that really stands out to me too is the fact that you guys came back together, you and Dwyer, at the end there, after all that you had gone through. To me, that seems something we need to figure out too. How do we get to that place? I know you said it's hard to describe, it's a very Boston thing, but how do we get to that on a human level, that sort of reunification?
I don't know. You know, maybe the Boston Irish culture has something to teach about that. I don't know. We can be incredibly combative with each other, and we can get over it in ways that even we don't understand. So I wish I gotta go figure that. When I figure that one out, that's the next book.
I think, yeah, indeed, we've given you your next book. Well, this is a tremendous book to revisit. It's on the one hand demoralizing to see how nothing has changed.
Well, let me tell you one huge thing that's changed as we run out. The Boston Police Department has progressed fantastically.
Yeah.
The current Boston Police Commissioner, Bill Evans, is one of the models for the country. This story that I'm telling in this book, I don't believe could happen again in Boston, and I really hope I'm right about that.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking with Lawrence O'Donnell about the new edition of his 1983 book, Deadly Force, A Police Shooting and My Family's Search for the Truth.